Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll talk with the AP's Ryan Foley. He'll have the story of two Iowa amputees who are suing a railroad in Iowa, saying it creates a danger. Also, Peggy Huppert of NAMI, Iowa, on the state's new mental health care law. Then in our second half hour, cross your fingers, that postponed live conversation with Congressman David Young of Iowa's 3rd District. We'll, of course, talk with him about the Farm Bill, that vote taking place just moments ago in Washington. Talk with him about trade with China, immigration policy as well. Congressman David Young of Iowa's 3rd District live in our second half hour. Live at the current time, Amy Mayer, reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
So let's talk about this farm bill, the $867 billion farm bill went down in flames.
That's moments ago.
What happened?
That's right. Well, this was the House version of the bill, and it there was a group of Republicans who are called the Freedom Caucus. They're very conservative Republicans, and they had their eyes on an immigration bill, and they were arguing earlier this week that they would not support the farm bill unless this immigration bill they wanted came to the floor first. And although there were apparently discussions late into the night last night, that immigration bill did not come forward. The House farm bill came up for a vote, and many of those Republicans didn't vote for it. Also, all the Democrats voted against the farm bill, and there were a handful of folks not voting. So the Republicans did not have enough votes to pass it.
Mm-hmm. Any possibility of bringing it up in the House again? What's its future, you think?
There's a couple of things that could happen. In the last go-round of the farm bill, we also saw the House bill rejected on the floor. So they can then either come up with another bill and put it through the House Ag Committee and bring it back up to the House for another vote, which is an option. They can wait until the Senate passes a bill and then just take the Senate bill to the House floor and see whether they can find compromise with that one. I think it will be up to both the House leadership as well as the House Ag Committee leadership to determine what their next steps will be.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the politics of the two houses are different. I was reading that, so had this passed, one interpretation, it was dead on arrival in the Senate, which is where Democrats are not in control, but more in control than they are in the House, right?
Correct. They are. It's a much closer majority-minority relationship or ratio in the Senate, and there's a lot more. There are many more members of the Senate who will cross party lines on certain issues related to the farm bill than you see happening in the House. For example, Senator Grassley, who is on the House Ag Committee, and Michigan Democrat Debbie Stabenow, who is the ranking member of that committee, have both spoken outwardly about the need to have a bipartisan farm bill. And different senators stand together on different issues. The farm bill is many, many parts and pieces, but you do tend to see less partisan scuffling in the Senate, even though you might see deep divides over particular issues or pieces of the bill.
Okay, Amy, something to keep our eyes on. Let's talk for a moment about Senator Grassley seeming to lose some patience over the renewable fuel standards. He says he's losing patience with deliberations on the renewable fuel standard. This mandates a certain amount of ethanol in our fuel, encourages the use of biofuels like ethanol. Grassley told reporters Tuesday of this week he wants the Trump administration to cut a fair deal between the corn and oil lobby. And if they don't, he'll hold Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt accountable.
Well, they better, or I'm going to be calling for Pruitt to resign because I'm done playing around with this.
Okay, the tone, we don't often hear that from Senator Grassley. Give us some background interpretation there of what's been going on with this renewable fuel standard, Amy.
President Trump made a commitment to honor the renewable fuel standard, and what Grassley has been arguing more emphatically in recent weeks, but for several months, is that decisions Scott Pruitt has made at EPA have been undercutting that commitment to the RFS. The RFS lays out exactly how many gallons of ethanol need to be blended into the fuel supply. It makes lots of other, or it sets lots of other requirements as well. And when the EPA grants, for example, hardship waivers, which is a procedure for allowing certain refineries to not meet their obligations, Senator Grassley argues that's a way to undercut the expectations of the law. And in so doing, he says Pruitt is not living up to the president's commitment, is therefore, you know, contradicting his boss, essentially. For a while, Senator Grassley was trying to emphasize that he supported Administrator Pruitt on lots of other aspects of his leadership at EPA and was just frustrated with the what seemed to be possible undercutting of the RFS. But now it seems that that concern over the RFS has perhaps taken on even more significance in Grassley's eyes.
Mm-hmm. Amy, we have about a minute left. Give us a quick idea of the Iowa Ag Secretary candidates. What's happening there? There's a half dozen of them or so, right?
That's correct, yes. There will be a Republican primary, a contested Republican primary. On the Democratic side, there's just one candidate, Tim Gannon, so there won't be any results from the primary, but we've got five people running on the Republican side. That includes Mike Negg, who is currently serving in the position, having been appointed by the governor when Bill Northey left to go to USDA. Several other leaders from agriculture, former Farm Bureau presidents, former presidents of the Soybean Association, and a current state senator, all vying for the position to lead the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship after 10 years of Bill Northey at the helm.
Okay. Iowa Public Radio's Amy Mayer, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Ben.
Yesterday, I want to mention we played part of a clip in which President Trump seemed to refer to some immigrants as animals. In fact, he made those comments in response to a specific question about an MS-13 gang member. MS-13 is an international crime gang. We'll be including the full audio of the president's comments on the web version of the story. We regret the error from yesterday, which was based on reporting from Washington at the time of yesterday's show.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Two Iowa women who lost limbs when they were struck while trying to climb through trains that were blocking the road are now suing the railroad company in question. Joining me now to explain the lawsuits, Ryan Foley, AP correspondent. He's been reporting on this story. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So, tell us about these lawsuits.
Yeah, the lawsuits were filed by two women who were struck by trains operated by Canadian National Railway in the east side of Waterloo last year in two separate incidents. They are suing the railroad, claiming that it has created a long-standing safety hazard in that part of the city because its trains routinely block several areas, making it impossible for pedestrians to pass for sometimes for hours at a time. And so while it is illegal and extremely dangerous to try to cross these trains, they say that's the reality that happens in Waterloo, you know, almost on a daily basis for some people. And they say the railroad has known about this hazard for some time and really hasn't taken steps to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Describe a little bit how these horrific injuries occur. So you have a train on the track, someone's wanting to get past it, and in these cases, what happened?
Yeah, they were either trying to walk through or crawl under, and the trains start moving without warning, and they, in some cases, you know, get run over, dragged down the tracks, and these women lost legs. Other people have lost arms and hands, and there have been five of these incidents, according to the lawsuits, going back to 1991.
Mm-hmm. So even though it's clear that a train like this poses a danger, the lawsuit says that this rail company, Canadian National, is just been using part of Waterloo as a sort of a shunting yard.
Yeah, a switching station. Yeah, the allegation is that the trains have gotten longer and longer, so some of them now are a mile or a mile and a half long, and that it's far larger than the rail yard in Waterloo. And so when they're doing maintenance, when they're loading and unloading cars and switching cars, it extends far into just a big part of the city where people live and block, you know, can block these intersections for multiple times a day for, you know, and sometimes an hour, sometimes even longer than that.
Right. So, and talk about the part of the part of Waterloo concerned here. It's important to know what part of Waterloo this is to understand the context and how this has been a source of frustration for residents. This is also a site where students of Waterloo East High School are affected, right?
Yep. Students of Waterloo East High School are affected. This is the east side of Waterloo, which is low income, heavily African American. So there is a lot of people who walk. There's a lot of people who use bicycles, and so it's extremely inconvenient for those individuals when the train is blocking their path. If they have appointments, if they're trying to get to different places or get to school, it's been a long-standing concern. In fact, Mayor Quentin Hart told me that he grew up in this neighborhood and has dealt with the train for problems for 40 years, and he thought when he became mayor a few years ago that he could make a difference on that, and he's been frustrated that he says he hasn't been able to get anywhere.
Mm-hmm. And he's been in contact with whom about it?
He's been in contact directly with the railroad, and he's been telling people to complain to federal representatives because the railroad is largely regulated by the Federal Railroad Administration, and so he's trying to bring some pressure that way, telling people to contact Senator Grassley or Senator Ernst and have them you know, try to put some kind of pressure on the railroad or the Federal Railroad Administration to deal with this issue.
What did the rail company, Canadian National, say when you contacted them about these lawsuits?
You know, in the past, they have acknowledged that, you know, the concerns in Waterloo that have been raised, but they've just said, you know, we do our best to minimize disruptions, but that operational necessities can cause them. And as far as these lawsuits, they just say that these are tragic incidents, but, you know, reminders that, you know, it's extremely dangerous and illegal to climb on trains and that, in their view, it no circumstances, you know, are worth the risk of these injuries.
Mm-hmm. Trains blocking, you know, roads and sidewalks for hours at a time. Aren't there regulations limiting how long a train in town can block a street or a sidewalk?
Yeah, in fact, Iowa law and Waterloo ordinance both state that trains cannot block public crossings for longer than 10 minutes at a time. But there are exceptions in those rules, and some pretty broad ones, including, you know, if the stops are necessary for complying with government regulations. And furthermore, the railroad contends that those laws don't really apply, since their main regulator is the Federal Railroad Administration, which. You know, I don't believe has a similar time limit.
Okay, my guess is nothing catches people's attention like lawsuits or not. I don't. Looking forward, what do you see, Ryan, happening here?
Well, you know, these women are represented by the most prominent law firm that represents victims of train accidents nationwide out of Kansas, attorney Bob Potroff, who has done battle in courtrooms with railroad companies with quite a bit of success over the years. I think it's going to be a lengthy court battle, but it'll be interesting to see, you know, if there are changes that result from this. And one of the things that they seem to be pushing for is the construction of a footbridge that would allow pedestrians to get over the tracks. The mayor says there's some that's building that is a little bit more difficult than it would seem, but we'll see where this goes.
Okay, Ryan Foley, thank you for keeping us up to date on this story. AP correspondent Ryan Foley covering the story of two Iowa women who lost limbs when they were struck trying to climb through trains in Waterloo, trains that were blocking the road. They're now suing the railroad company in question.
Canadian National. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, so let's talk to Peggy Hubbard, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Iowa, NAMI Iowa. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Ben. Nice to see you.
Nice.
Or I guess I'm not seeing you. I'm hearing you.
All right. Peggy, nice to talk with you. Let's talk about some mental health that's been in the news. I want to get your read on some things here. Governor Reynolds signed a new mental health law in March. It expands mental health services across our state, creating 6 access centers to provide short-term care for people in crisis, doubles the number of teams across the state that provide 24/7 flexible treatment and support to patients. How do you size it up for answering to some of Iowa's deficiencies in the area of mental health care?
It's significant. It's a very significant health policy piece of legislation. It's going to really beef up our continuum of care available for Iowans with the most serious mental health needs, which is sorely lacking right now.
Mm-hmm. Pick it apart a little bit. Tell me about what's most valuable in this new law to you.
Well, I think everyone might look at this and see different things that are most valuable to them. And we saw that with our complex needs work group, which came up with the recommendations. Law enforcement are most excited about the access centers because they are going to be 24/7 secure, no eject, no reject facilities, no farther than 90 minutes from any Iowan, that's the goal, where law enforcement or family members can take people who are in crisis. And they will be safe, they will be secure, they will be evaluated and assessed, and then they will be referred to the most appropriate level of treatment, whatever that is, that mm-hmm. can be determined.
And let me jump in there. So prior to these 6 access centers, what would have happened to a person, a family member in crisis?
Well, for the most part, they either go to an emergency room and often sit there for a long time, often with law enforcement, and then they're either admitted or they're let go. That's very typical. The other outcome is they end up in jail.
Okay.
So obviously neither of those are preferred outcomes.
Right.
So
okay.
Access centers were a high priority for law enforcement and for people who deal in crisis situations.
What other things are you picking apart here that you like especially?
Well, the ACT teams. Those are evidence-based. It stands for Assertive Community Treatment. Currently, we have 11 in Iowa. They're a multidisciplinary team that provides wraparound, comprehensive services for a person so that they can stay in the community. And they're headed by a psychiatrist. They are really going to make a difference when we are able to double the amount, because right now it's just all in urban areas. We need to get them out into the rural areas, and we need to be able to, this is going to help people stay in their communities.
Mm-hmm. Has the legislature, with this new mental health law, provided adequate funding?
Well, counties through the regions are financially responsible for adult mental health services under Iowa law, and they do that through the mental health levy, and currently the regions collectively have about $150 million in reserve. They also have untapped levying capacity. So for the next year or two, in combination with Medicaid paying for many of these services, the funding should be there. Now, after that, once the reserves are spent down and a lot of these services are online, there will be a funding issue, and that is something the legislature will have to deal with.
Let's talk about kids, Peggy. The governor also signed an executive order this in April creating a children's mental health board. Governor Reynolds says it's the first of many steps to improve children's mental health services in the state. Comment on that. How significant?
It's significant. Unfortunately, there is no children's mental health system in Iowa. There has been an adult system for a while. It used to be 99 counties. Now it's 14 regions funded through this property tax levy. But the kids have kind of been left behind. There are services being provided, but they're fragmented. There's really no one accountable for making sure that the services are out there. There's no crisis services at all, which is a real problem, especially for adolescents. If they're in crisis, really the only, again, it's the emergency room or a juvenile detention center, neither of which are the most appropriate place for that person to be. So we really need to get going. There's been attempts for, really the last 4 or 5 years, and there has been some progress, but not enough.
Looks like an exciting event at NAMI Iowa that you have tonight in Des Moines. It's called Beautiful Minds is what it's called. Tell us about it.
Well, this is a new event for us. We just started it last year. The idea is to celebrate the connection between creativity and mental illness because it's a strong connection. And what we found in doing just a little bit of research is there are many famous people who accomplished great things. Scientists, artists, actors, other creative people who lived with serious mental illness. And unfortunately, if they lived, anything other than the very near, not that long ago, or if they're still with us, it was a very difficult situation because it was the stigma.
Right.
So we're celebrating that. We have found local actors who are portraying famous people from history who live with mental illness. They are going to be at our event in costume, as that character. The people who are musical will be doing some singing. we have local folks who have opened up their homes. So we're having a reception to start the evening at Des Moines University, which, by the way, the governor is attending, and we're very excited about that. But then people are going to disperse to these homes, and each home will have their own character for the evening to talk to them and be entertained.
Right, and I'm seeing on the release characters playing the parts of Mark Twain, Judy Garland, Doris Day. Sounds wonderful.
Yep.
And it's
and in fact, Judy and Doris will be doing a duet at the reception.
Wow. Okay. Sounds exciting. Peggy Huppert, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Iowa, NAMI, Iowa. Peggy, always wonderful to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up in just a moment, to that postponed live conversation with Congressman David Young of Iowa's 3rd District. Of course, we'll ask him about the Farm Bill, trade with China, immigration policy. We have our eyes on that shooting tragedy in Texas unfolding now. We'll ask him about that. Congressman David Young of Iowa's 3rd District, coming up in just a few minutes. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Glad you're joining us midstream in this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. For the entire second half hour, we're glad to have that postponed live interview with U.S. Congressman David Young of Iowa's 3rd District. He joins us from Washington. Congressman Young, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's good to be with you. How are you?
Doing very well. I want to remind our listeners, the 3rd District covers the southwest portion of the state. It's roughly the area, including Des Moines to Nebraska and the Missouri borders. Congressman David Young, first elected in 2014. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Congressman, I need to ask you about the tragedy again at the top of our news. It looks like, according to the reports I'm seeing, at least 9 dead at a Santa Fe high school in Texas. What's the solution here to the rash of school shootings? For instance, age restrictions or restricting access to some guns. Is that part of the solution you could get behind?
Well, first of all, it's just horrific what we've been seeing. Although gun crime is down, we see these bizarre incidences of school shootings or mass shootings. And we need to get a control of all violence and the stem of that. And so we've already started this year in the House, just as recently as just a few months ago, we passed the Stop School Violence Act, which I supported, which will help schools not only with some of the hardware, Ben, that we talk about, whether it's cameras or motion detectors or panic buttons or those kind of things, but also funds for school resource officers and also funding for mental health. So there can be some assessments there of students and behavioral counselors and those kind of things. And with that, we also wanted to put some real teeth in our background check system because there's just been too many holes in it. And many times we are seeing people being able to get guns who never should have been able to get them if the background check system was really working and in place between states, even the military, because we saw what happened down in Texas at that church from that that guy who was charged with domestic abuse. He was in the Air Force. He never should have been able to purchase that gun. And so we have taken some steps, and just even recently as yesterday, as part of the Appropriations Committee that I'm on, we passed a bill out of committee that provides funds for what they call extreme risk protection orders or gun violence protection orders, which allows law enforcement officers, medical, mental health professionals, school officials, family members to be able to obtain court orders for the temporary removal of firearms from persons shown to be clearly and convincingly a danger to themselves and to others. So mm-hmm. we are doing some things. It is a tragedy. And
Are you willing to stand up to the NRA lobby on limits, the ones that you're talking about, and perhaps others?
Well, you know, I've always been a supporter of the Second Amendment and just for a long time, and so that's where the Constitution is where I foment my belief on the Second Amendment and why it's important. And so, but I think there are some things that we can do, and we have been doing them here already. And, of course, states can have flexibility as well to do some things, and we've seen some things being done in states already in terms of what I just mentioned, extreme risk protection orders or gun violence protection orders, and funding for internally for schools to protect children and teachers. And we want teachers to be able to teach with peace of mind in schools to be safe places, of course, and parents to have an ease of mind and students to have an ease of mind that they're being protected and they're in a safe place and they're learning.
Let's talk about the other big news today. You were just involved in this vote. The Farm Bill did not pass by quite a margin, some 20 votes there in the U.S. House, the $867 billion Farm Bill. In your eyes, why did it fail?
Well, back to the drawing board, it did fail. And so traditionally the Farm Bill has been pretty bipartisan. So I think there was some concern that some had, and I'm not sure I've subscribed to it because I looked at this very carefully regarding some work requirements for those on food stamps. And there are already some work requirements within the law, and this would have enhanced them, those who are 18 to 59 years old, able-bodied, able-minded, no children, be required to do 20 hours of work or have training or volunteer each week.
And you were behind, you were behind that part.
I supported the farm. So I voted for the Farm Bill, I thought those work requirements made sense. But I had some provisions in this bill as well regarding, you know, we have an issue with water in Iowa and across the Midwest, soil health, water quality. I had some language in there called the Stress Act, which helps our farmers and producers who have the highest suicide rates out there amongst professions. And as well, a new seat within USDA, a food waste and loss reduction liaison. But let's get to the other reason why I think this Farm Bill failed, and that is because there's a certain segment called the Freedom Caucus, and many, and maybe some others as well who don't define themselves as that or in that caucus, who wanted to have some kind of leverage to bring about an immigration bill, what they call the Representative Goodlatte's bill. And I'm not sure that they got those commitments from leadership that that would come up. And so I think perhaps some of them voted no. And we saw a lot of this in the press, voted no on the bill until they got those assurances. Mm-hmm. So we got to go back to the drawing board. Maybe we need a little cooling down over here on that. And the Senate, of course, can go forward and do what they want to do as well, and they are proceeding.
Back to the SNAP provision there, the work requirements that were added to this bill. Do you think, in hindsight, it's a good idea to add these requirements? You support them. You voted for this bill. If they politicize an important bill for farmers, a bill that hasn't been this political in the past?
Well, I look at what is needed out there within the workforce, and there's a lot of jobs out there, and a lot of employers need to hire folks, and if they're not fit for those jobs, there's training there, and that can be used to help folks get into the workforce. And this isn't meant to be punishing, of course. We want to have that strong food stamp, SNAP safety net for those who need it, and many do. But we want to try to encourage them and help them as well transition to the workforce and still be able to have that safety net of food stamps, which is much, much needed, of course,
This bill,
in urban and rural areas.
Congressman David Young with us, if you've just joined us. Congressman, this bill this morning failed by a pretty good margin. Republicans by a pretty good margin in the majority in the House. What do you say to your constituents in Iowa about Iowa or about the House leadership, the GOP leadership, if it can't approve a farm bill, if you bring it up to vote and it really doesn't even come close?
Yeah, well, obviously we have to, I voted for it, and obviously we have to get the votes. And so there's going to have to be, you can't just pull up the same bill, I don't believe, and vote on it again. I think you'll get the same result or maybe even worse, maybe better. I don't know, but
What about the GOP leadership in the House? What does this say about the GOP leadership?
Well, you know, the agriculture bill is interesting because it's more of a geographical issue, and I think we go back to the table, and that's fine, and work out some kind of compromise, probably on some of the work requirements or SNAP food stamps issue, and maybe get some assurances if the leadership is willing to do it to bring an immigration bill, the Goodlatte bill, to the floor. And so, you know, not everything goes through on the first time. We've seen that before.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Part of this farm bill, you mentioned the Freedom Caucus there, got tied up with immigration and wanted to debate an immigration bill. The Freedom Caucus, as I understand the reporting, there was a petition to allow petition to allow a full debate of the immigration reform against the wishes of the House leadership. Would you support such a discharge petition to have a full House debate on immigration? Why or why not?
I want to have debate on immigration, particularly when it comes to the DACA, Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals, and the Dreamer issue and border security. So I think we're getting there. I think we may get there without the discharge petition. I think that's being used really now as a point of leverage. I'm not sure forcing a vote on something is the way to do that, where we don't have a clear path and strategy and even on a bill, on policy. And so we do need to address it. I do believe it needs to be done in a bipartisan way. And we need to find a permanent solution for DACA recipients. And I don't want to be back here in 3 years with the same problem. I want to solve this. I want to give a permanent status for DACA recipients and make sure the border is secure as well.
Okay, so describe that path concisely that you support to solve the DACA problem.
Well, I think, first of all, you want to make sure, just back up a little bit, you know, the DACA recipients and Dreamers, all they know is America, and they want to stay here. Sending them away, they'd be strangers in a strange land. And I don't want to do that to them. And those who are here and they're, you know, law-abiding, many of them are opening small businesses, they're students, they're in the military, I want them to stay here. But I also want to be sure that we're not in a position in 3 or 4 years again where we have the same issue. And so that's why I think you need to tie it to border security. And for me, Ben, border security means different sectors of the border have different needs. San Diego, you need more Coast Guard. You probably need more ground-penetrating radar because of tunnels. In Arizona and Cochise County, you need Border Patrol on horseback. You may need drones over Texas in some areas. You may need some wall funding and fortified fencing in some areas, too. I don't want to see a wall between the Gulf of Mexico and San Diego. And I also think you need to address what they call family reunification or chain migration and reform that just to the nuclear family. I think We need e-verify in that as well. So those are a few of the things right now that I would like to see addressed.
Do you support the DACA provisions in the Denham bill?
Well, I don't know that I've necessarily seen those provisions specifically. But I know that there are four or five bills that the Queen of the Hill is kind of four bills. It's the Good Lad bill. People are talking about the DREAM Act, a Herd Aguilar bill called the USA Act. And then there would be another bill that leadership would put together or pull from what's already been introduced and go from there. But I think we need to address this.
Mm-hmm. Congressman David Young with us for this second half hour of River to River. Congressman, we had an immigration raid last week in Iowa. I'm sure you're well aware of it. Resulted in 32 men taken into custody by ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, from Mount Pleasant. We had some of their family members. A family member joined us yesterday, a 17-year-old woman. Well, she's been here 17 years since she was 3 years old. Real hardships for these family. This evidently her father working here for many years at this cement factory, now in detention. Who should be held responsible for the fact that allegedly undocumented workers were employed at that cement plant?
Well, I think the employers, ultimately. I mean, we need, you know, there are some business practices where, you know, you talk about human trafficking, and it's not just of you know, of a sexual nature, but labor practices as well. And I think that employers should be held accountable there. And I'm hoping that if we can get to a bill that these kind of things, enhanced penalties can be put down on employers to make sure that this doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. We often
hear... And it's a very sad situation all around. You have many, many people who come here illegally, but they want a better life. They're escaping some horrible situations. I understand that. And my gosh, of course they want to come to America. Everybody wants to come here. And so I don't dispel upon them their wanting to come here. I do dispel upon the concrete plant and the business that did this to maybe lure them in some unsavory way and not treat them well.
Nevertheless, there are those jobs for them, valuable jobs that are contributing to our economy. We often hear the immigrants taking jobs away from U.S. citizens. That's what we hear in slogans, campaign slogans. But in Iowa, we often hear from businesses who can't fill their available jobs with Iowans, whether it's farm laborers, meatpacking, or construction. So how do we solve that problem, Congressman? Do we need to raise wages, improve conditions, locate elsewhere?
Well, I think we're probably going to have to find a way to bring in some more labor, but do it in a way where it's, you know, above the board, on the table, not undercut in any way with wages. And, you know, in one of the bills, it's the Good Lad bill. He's chairman of the Judiciary Committee, which is the bill that a lot of folks want to bring to the floor. It raises the H-2C green cards from $120,000 to $175,000 a year. And so that could be helpful, and that could be part of the solution, but by doing nothing, then we're going to continue to see what we're seeing. And I don't think it's a good place for anybody.
Comment, we're running out of time, 5 minutes or so left. Please comment on President Trump's ongoing trade feud with China, also tied up with the farm bill today, evidently. Comment on both those, because Iowa farmers are in a dire situation, aren't they? Failure of a farm bill, trade feud with China that is working against our agricultural exports.
Well, you know, I am confident that we're ultimately going to get a farm bill, and the Senate has to act as well. But when it comes to, you know, trade and tariffs, I'm really concerned with the trade war. And, you know, the retaliation comes first against agriculture, and it's already started. And we need more markets. We don't need markets pulled away. It's easy to lose a market, Ben, but it's hard to gain them. Mm-hmm. So I'm very concerned about tariffs. I see them as taxes on consumers. Employers have to make decisions then, and they may have to let go of employees. And, you know, China's a bad actor. We all know that. You know, the president is trying to do something, and a lot of people are saying, well, he's taking them seriously. But at what cost? You wonder sometimes. I hope that the tariffs issue is just being used as a threat for a point of leverage to get China to the table before any tariffs would ever take effect. And they could take effect as early as June.
Mm-hmm.
But we have relations with, you know, the trade deficit with China, stealing of our intellectual property. Those are things that we need to deal with and are very serious.
In the last few days, we've heard of the company, the Chinese telecommunications giant ZTE. Looks like the president is backing away from trade restrictions on that communications giant in China. What do you make of these developments thrown in that context?
Well, I just have to think that he's trying to use that in some way as a point of leverage in trade negotiations with China. But I am very concerned with the security of ZTE devices being sold. And I'm watching this, and my colleagues are, pretty seriously as well.
Yeah.
And, of course, our country, the Commerce Department, has banned any American business from selling products or services to ZTE for a while now.
And the concern there is that there could be something in the hardware that could spy unbeknownst to us on our people?
Yep, exactly. I think so. And we have to be very suspicious of them for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Are you concerned that U.S. trade policy seems to be based on, you've heard this phrase, whoever had the president's ear at the moment, the last person? Are you concerned there?
Well, you know, if you go back in the archives and history of Donald Trump, the president, before he was president, you know, he's been speaking out, you know, for decades about trade deficits, unfair trade practices out there, and not the law not being enforced, the need to modernize, and the need to make sure that America gets the better end of all this. And so I think it's helpful to have many voices in your ear on this. I sure wanted to make sure that the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, is in the room when the president's talking about trade, those kind of things. Because he understands trade, especially when it comes to agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Speaker Ryan will be the leader of the House, leader of your party in the House, up until January, I believe. Who do you support as a successor to Paul Ryan?
Well, you know, some people are there's some chattering back there, you know, kind of parlor games, you know, who's in, who's out. I don't pay attention to that stuff because I tell my colleagues or anyone else who's asking what I think, I say, first of all, for me to have a voice in who the Speaker of the House is, we have to make sure that we win the majority. And so that's where it stops for me. And so and who knows who that's going to be in terms of who's running for Speaker. You don't even have to be a member of Congress. So, Ben, if you want me to put your name in, let me know.
What would you say? betting was in the news this week, but let's just put it in terms. 50-50 chance that the Republicans will hold on to the House, a less than 50-50 chance? What do you put it at?
If it was today, I think we would still retain majority, but I think we would lose seats.
Okay.
Because a lot of it is because of some interesting redistricting that's gone around in the country, particularly Pennsylvania.
Right. We've been reporting on that. Hmm. Yesterday, the one-year anniversary since Special Counsel Robert Mueller started his investigation into Russian interference into our elections, possible ties to the Trump campaign. To date, 19 people charged, four of them Trump campaign advisors. We have guilty pleas there. Donald Trump saying this week, this is bigger than Watergate because of his deep state conspiracy theory, deep state conspiracy against him. The often repeated witch hunt. Which version of reality, drastic different in the realities that we have here, one put out by the White House, others say this is bigger than Watergate because of Donald Trump's collusion and obstruction. Which reality do you tend to go with?
Well, I don't know if you measure it against, you know, one scandal or another in history and just look at it on its merits and contents. And so I just am waiting for Mueller, the special investigator, to conclude his investigation. I don't know when that's going to be. I think a lot of Americans on both sides of the aisle, or maybe no political affiliation, would like this to happen sooner rather than later, but not prematurely, so we don't have to be guessing, well, you know, after the fact about anything that else could come up. We want to make sure that the investigation goes forward, and as well make sure that the committees in both the House and Senate are able to do their investigating as well. It's I'm sure it's distracting for the president, I try not to be distracted with all that stuff and am just really focusing on policies from the White House, policies in Congress, mm-hmm. and what I'm hearing in the 3rd District.
With just a few seconds left, but could you believe in Donald Trump's deep state conspiracy theory against him? Is that a possibility you hold out as a real possibility of what's happening?
Well, I mean, I'm sure out there the president is... He's being accused. Put yourself in the president's situation. You're being accused of colluding with Russia, and you believe you're innocent, and that's going to make you uncomfortable and cause you to say something sometimes. But I'm sure, he works hard every day. He's doing his best despite all this, and that's what I'm doing.
U.S. Congressman David Young, thank you so much for. The postponed interview, making good today, live from Washington. Congressman David Young, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Natalia Reyes today. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.